This is On Target St. John's, a look at politics, crime, education. What's happening here with the people who know? The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station. Now, your On Target St. John's host, Linda Swain.
Good afternoon, everyone. If you've listened to this show long enough, you know that I'm a big fan of heritage in Newfoundland and Labrador and history and all things that help tell a tale. Well, the preservation of heritage, as we all know, has always been challenging here in Newfoundland and Labrador. The province's rich history, of course, is wrapped up in some of its structures, both iconic and humble. Tourists flock to the province to see the colorful buildings and learn more about our unique way of life. What kind of impact did the pandemic have on efforts to preserve heritage? Well, here to discuss that topic is the executive director of the Heritage Foundation, Heritage NL, Jerry Dick. Hi, Jerry.
Hi.
So what's the last year been like for heritage preservation and restoration here in Newfoundland and Labrador?
Oh, it seems like it's been a really busy year. Some projects maybe, you know, community sort of projects have been delayed a little bit in terms of challenges around, you know, resources and that kind of thing. But, you know, other projects have been going ahead. And in the meantime, we've been doing a lot of research and some planning work on a number of heritage projects.
Well, a heartbreaker late last year, of course, was the demolition of the historic Keynes House in Norris Point. What made that building so important?
Well, that was, I'm not sure, that was designated a number of years by the foundation. We don't have a lot of buildings in that area, so I think it was kind of important. They were, the owners of the property were a small merchant, so it's really one of a small number of heritage structures that are left in the community of Norris Point.
So what happened that it couldn't be saved?
Well, I think to some degree it's kind of a communication issue. The property was sold to a new owner, and we're not entirely sure whether they were fully aware of what the designation meant or some of the services that we could have provided to the owner. I understand, you know, the property had gone downhill somewhat, but we could have supported them with funding and that sort of thing for restoration. So that one's really unfortunate that we lost that one.
It seems as though that a heritage property is no more at peril than when it is sold or it changes hands. Why does it seem that way?
Well, I guess when whoever, so the way the whole designation process works is it's the owner, it's driven by the owners of the building. So they're obviously people who are interested in the history of a building and in seeing it preserved. And so when it goes into other hands, they may have other ideas or they may not value the property or understand it in the same way that maybe the original owner did.
So what happened that I understand Heritage NL learned about the demolition through a Facebook post? Is that part of that level of communication that you're talking about? And how do you improve that?
Yeah, it's a real challenge because we have approximately 340 registered heritage structures in the province, and our office is located in St. John, so it's quite challenging sometimes to keep track of what's going on in all these communities. So what we're trying to do is reach out to the municipalities because these are the agencies that permit construction or building permits or demolition permits. So if we can get on their radar and they can say, okay, this is a designated building, maybe somebody needs to make contact with Heritage NL first. So we think that's maybe our best bet because it's often difficult to keep track when the ownership of the property has changed.
Do municipalities have a mandate to preserve heritage? Oftentimes, you know, you hear them say, well, we're rezoning. We only have permission to change the zoning of a particular area. And then, you know, it's carte blanche for the owner to do as they see fit, whatever it happens to be. They usually apply for a zoning permit of some kind. So does a municipality have that ability to preserve heritage or just be able to put a pause on something and say, wait now, let's look into this a little bit first?
Municipalities have a really important role to play in heritage preservation. The Municipalities Act enables them to do their own designations. So we would heartily encourage any municipality to designate their own heritage structures, and a number have done that. And they're really the closest on the ground. So as I said, you know, they see when any permits come in. So they do have a real ability to support heritage preservation. In some instances, like St. John's and CBS, they have small restoration grant programs which can further assist. And then also through municipal planning, through the zoning process, they certainly can manage the heritage structures in their communities.
It seems to me that when a heritage property is in peril or its future is questioned in some way, the process in preserving it is so painfully slow, or not the preservation, but you know, the movements towards its eventual demise is so painfully slow. It's like watching, inevitably it's coming to an end, but nobody seems able to stop it.
Yeah, what we'd really like to do is try and get more proactive, because when a property is really at risk for a variety of reasons, I mean, it's maybe in serious physical condition, or an owner who isn't interested in preserving it and wants to maybe demolish it, it's often too late, and then it feels like you're banging your head against the wall to try and make something positive happen. So one of the initiatives that we're going to be undertaking over the next year and two is to really, really try and identify those historic places that potentially could be at risk. So we think of maybe, we know there's a lot of churches, historic church buildings being closed. So let's identify these and let's do some thinking ahead of time around how could we adaptively reuse or preserve these buildings, and then to provide communities with some of the tools that can help that happen. So I think, the key is to try and be more proactive.
My guest today on Target is the Executive Director of Heritage NL, Jerry Dick. We'll be back right after this.
Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
My guest today is the Executive Director of Heritage NL, and we're Jerry Dick, of course, and we're talking a little bit about heritage and some of what goes into the preservation of some of our more iconic buildings and even the lesser known ones. But you were talking about Kane's House in Norris Point, registered heritage designation. What goes into a registered heritage designation?
Well, as I mentioned before, it's an application is put forward by the owner or manager of the property. And then they try and put together kind of the case for historical and architectural significance. And then we have a committee that reviews that and determines whether it meets the bar. It's not just every building that we will designate. It has to tell kind of an important story, maybe a provincially significant story, for it to be designated. Designation itself is commemorative. There are no real protections in place until such time as we provide grant money. So we have grant programs to support the reservation and preservation and maintenance of these structures. So at that time, then, we enter into an easement agreement, which is actually a legal agreement that requires the owner to abide by, appropriate standards for heritage conservation.
And you're responsible, too, for, digging up a little bit of the history on a property as well. Is that correct?
That's right. And increasingly, we're trying to do more research on buildings, because I've run into it over and over again. You think you know the story and the history of a building, and once you start digging into it, you find that there's a lot more to that. So we're actually thinking about making that it kind of a two-stage process. When you apply, you provide what information you can, and then we'll go and do some more detailed research, whether that be, looking at the building, doing kind of digging through the archives, or doing some interviews to capture some of more the intangible aspects of a place, like some of the stories. So we've been doing that for a few properties lately. One of them is Landfall Trust in Brigus, and through our research, we've been able to kind of better capture how that building evolved over time. in some cases, you can maybe disprove things that are commonly understood about a building. In another case, where recently we've been researching the Lane House in Selvage, which is actually it was one of the first community museums in the province. So that had been designated a number of years ago. It's the museum's been kind of inactive for the last few years. So we've gone in and started doing some research, and we looked at it and realized it's probably a much older building than anybody thinks. By looking underneath, we saw that there was probably an old inglenook chimney, which suggests that, that the building's actually probably pretty early, maybe built before 1840, which is much earlier than the community originally assumed.
Any real surprises, though, when you go into some of these properties? I mean, oftentimes people in a community will be aware that, this house is named after this particular family who lived there, and that's significant because this member of that family did these things. But do you find things that go well beyond that?
Well, often you might find some things about how buildings were used in the past. So maybe this building served as, well, in some cases we found out, it was a telegraph office, or it served some other purpose that maybe wasn't readily understood. And very often when you start to really look at the building itself, you realize that it's undergone many changes. I mean, I think about my own, the house I live is an 1890s Victorian house on Hamilton Avenue, and I always thought I knew, it was changed in 1930, and it looks like what it does now. And I looked at an historic photo, and I found out that from the 1890s, that in fact it was somewhat different than I had assumed. So again, when you do your research, it's kind of like a puzzle. You start to put together, well, here's really how this building has evolved over time.
And it really is an evolution. You're very right when you say, sometimes you look at these pictures of a building that you thought you knew, and you have to look at it twice because it doesn't quite look the same. Its aspect might be different. There might be changes to the roof or windows or even the number of floors involved. So when you designate a heritage property and renovations are needed, what standard do you decide upon?
Well, generally, the thinking has changed a bit in terms of preserving or restoring an historic building. It used to often be, okay, we want to restore it to how it was built. And now we recognize that, well, a building has a story. It's evolved maybe through different uses and certainly different owners. Tastes have changed. The requirements or needs of the people who live in the building or occupy the building. So we're interested in capturing all that full story. So it's not necessarily about kind of preserving it in a particular time, as long as those changes are sympathetic to the historic character. Often we'll, if there's vinyl siding and vinyl windows and stuff like that, well, that's not something we're necessarily interested in. And in terms of, when you do have your building designated, it's not a case of you can't make any changes. Buildings are functional things. They have to serve the needs of their occupants. So we'll certainly work with the owner of a heritage building to make changes, maybe to make additions. And what we're particularly concerned about is that the heritage values are preserved and that whatever is new is sympathetic to the old. And in considering that, we have the National Standards and Guidelines for Conservation in Canada, of historic places in Canada, and that gives us some direction in terms of how we approach these things.
Do we have enough craftspeople in Newfoundland and Labrador to do it right, so to speak? I understood that not too long ago we had but one person who knew how to do wooden windows anymore. So how do you make sure that we have the right skills out there to do things properly if and when a heritage structure needs those necessary repairs?
Yeah, that's increasingly a problem, not only in this province, but across the country. I saw recently that Quebec indicates that, you know, they only have so many people involved in heritage conservation. They're interested in training. So here, for example, we have a very small number of people who know about historic masonry repair. I don't think we have anybody anymore. I'm not sure aware of them who do hard wall plastering. So we actually were very fortunate to get a major funding package from the provincial government, over $400,000, to deliver some training over the next couple of years. So there's kind of two focuses for that. One is on traditional building practices. So we're going to target that to existing contractors and carpenters to kind of expand their skill set. And then the other side of that is we're doing through Dale Jarvis's office, the Intangible Heritage Office, we're looking at traditional skills and knowledge at risk. So a lot of skills that were, you know, an important part of people's the economy, household economy, they're disappearing. So we want to do some training in those to keep the skills alive, and also to see if, you know, there can be kind of a new spin on that. So I'll just give the example of barking, and that was the tradition of whereby they would boil up bark in a pot, and then that would act as a preservative for fishing nets, for sail, and also for clothing. And so now in Labrador we're seeing an entrepreneur who produces clothing using that style of dyeing and preserving fabric. So we think, you know, there's possibly a new spin on some of these traditional skills. So we're quite excited about that.
And money to be had there?
Yeah, $433,000 has been approved for a two-year period.
But is there interest from carpenters and other craftspeople to say, you know, I've always wanted to know how to do this. Dad used to be able to do this, but I can't do it. You know, do you have people coming to you and say, I'd like to be able to do this because I want to do it in my house. It reminds me of Nan's or something like that?
We have reached out to, and we have delivered some training. We did one, for example, in the restoration of historic windows. We did that a couple of years ago, and there were about a dozen carpenters came forward for that. And we have done some survey work. So we think there's definitely interest out there, and now, you know, we just got this funding announced, so we're going to start developing these different training modules and promoting them and generating some further interest in them.
And what about materials?
Yeah, that's another challenge these days, in that the building and materials we have today, especially when we think about maybe reconstructing a window, we're tending to use the pine that you get at the local building supply store. And those are plantation grown. They're often very soft. In the old days, they would use old growth wood to make a window, and that would last a long, long time. So finding the quality materials is often a challenge for doing restoration work. Sometimes even the tools. We've done interviews of some of the older generation of carpenters, and they showed us some of their old tools that maybe they inherited from their father or grandfather. And they were made with hand-forged steel that kept its edge and it didn't rust. So we have a lot of challenges now in trying to keep our old buildings in good shape. You know, from having the skill sets to do it to having the availability of materials and even the tools to work with.
And all those hand-hewn pieces of wood as well. I'm thinking about those big logs that are, you know, planed down by hand or in machines that no longer really exist, except in perhaps some small sawmills in and around the town, province. Do you have difficulty in getting pieces of wood that are properly cut or hewn?
Well, I would say today that when we're having to replace these elements, we generally don't require, to hand hew something. I mean, there's the skill set and the tools. I don't know, you know, if too many people have those. And there's just then, of course, the time that it takes to do it. So what we encourage is, okay, let's preserve as much of the original building fabric as possible so that people can see that, okay, this is how this building was built and that's how wood was prepared. standard, but we would allow, you know, modern sawn timber or lumber to be used when you have to replace deteriorated building fabric.
Which would be good for a heritage property owner to know because, you know, when you think about heritage, sometimes it can be quite daunting. Do you find that it's a detriment to some owners who might love a property but say, oh, do I really want to get into all of this?
Well, you certainly have to be committed to the idea of having your building preserved because there's no question that it's going to, in many cases, it's going to be more expensive in terms of both the labor and perhaps the materials. So, you know, if you have a designated building and it originally had a wood shingled roof, that's going to be more costly. And we encourage people to restore their original wood windows, and that takes a certain skill set. But that's where our funding programs come in place, that they're intended to try and take away that differential. So, for example, we've done a calculation of, well, what would it cost to put on an asphalt shingled roof versus a wood shingled roof? And it's about, you know, half the price. So we provide up to 50% of the cost of restoring that roof. So that's how we're trying to, to address that additional cost. And as well, we can provide a lot of technical information on, you know, what the best approaches are and how to, you know, put reclapboard your building, what kind of paint to use, those kinds of things.
I want to get into adaptive use when we come back after the break. My guest today on Target is the Executive Director of Heritage NL, Jerry Dick. We'll be back right after this.
Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
My guest today on Target is the Executive Director of Heritage NL, Jerry Dick. And just before the break, we were talking about a number of ways in which, some of the challenges involved in the preservation of heritage properties. But adaptive use has really come into a lot more of the conversation lately. Jerry, what difference does that make in helping to preserve properties in Newfoundland and Labrador?
Oh, that's a really critical piece. If a building doesn't have a use, it really doesn't have a future. There's no reason for anybody to invest in that building's upkeep. And so very often buildings are, they're abandoned or they're no longer used anymore. Or as I mentioned earlier, we're seeing a lot of churches that are being closed and divested by the various church organizations. So unless we can find a new use for these structures, it's going to be very difficult to preserve them over the long term. So that's been a really major focus of Heritage NL over the last few years. We did a conference a few years ago called Adapting Heritage, and we turned a lot of that into a toolkit, which anyone can find on our website. Over the last couple of years, we've been working really closely, particularly with a number of community groups that own heritage buildings, to try and find new uses. And we've done some adaptive reuse studies. So if anyone's familiar with the Greens Pond Courthouse, that was closed, and then it served as a community museum for several years, and then it was closed. And the building really started to deteriorate, and the town was very concerned about it, even to the point where some people were saying, well, this is an eyesore. We should tear it down. Fortunately, the town, which owns the courthouse, and this is one of your kind of classic Newfoundland rural courthouses with a tower on it, they were able to get some funding to do restoration work. And then with the assistance of last summer, I had three architecture students working with us, and they did an adaptive reuse study where they looked at, okay, here's some concepts around developing the main floor as a tap room and then the upper floor, which was the jailer's residence, into a vacation rental property. So we put this all together into a report, and then the town is actually out there now soliciting interest. You know, here are just a couple of ideas of what the building could be used for. And so they're hopefully by the end of January, anybody who's interested will have reached out to the town and expressed their interest. And we've actually seen some strong interest in some of these ideas we had identified. And we'll hopefully see a new group that will probably lease the building. So, you know, there's a reason to keep the building going. In another case, this past summer, we were doing work in Harbor Grace, and we, if anyone's familiar, the Ridley Hall ruins is, it was, the Ridley Hall was a very impressive stone residence that was built by Thomas Ridley in 1834. He was one of the, or the major merchant in the community at that time. And over its history, at one point it served as a cable office. But anyways, in the early 2000s, the building was, there was arson and the building was seriously damaged. And so now it's there as a ruin. So we did a study on, well, how could we adapt this building as a ruin? Restoring the whole building would probably be cost, very, very costly, but and prohibitive. So we looked at restoring it as a ruin, as community garden and a community venue. So we're hoping that these kind of studies can help stimulate thinking in the community about what might be possible for some of these structures.
Indeed, because when that fire occurred at Ridley Hall, and you and I go way back, when it comes to Harbor Grace and what's been going on there, I remember your work with the Otterbury Schoolhouse and the Garrison House and that. There was a lot of work done at the time, pressuring government to come up with some funding federally and provincially to save that iconic structure. And when the fire happened, the wind came out of a lot of people's sales in thinking that that's it now, it's gone forever, we might as well get the bulldozer and bulldoze it down. But to see this whole idea of a community garden around the ruin really opened my eyes, I guess, as a casual observer to some of these possibilities.
Well, and that was the advantage of what we were able to do last summer. I mean, having the skills of architecture students, designers who could graphically show us what's possible. And the study for Ridley Hall was actually part of a larger study or plan that was done for the Harbor Grace Heritage District. And Ridley Hall is kind of, right in the middle of it. The old courthouse, the Immaculate Conception Church, and other designated buildings are all part of that. So we did a plan to show how this area could be developed, could become a real amenity, not only for tourists, but also for residents, just to, as a nicer place to walk and discover and learn about the community. And when we did the presentation to the community, people said, we've had lots of ideas, but we've never been able to kind of visualize it and put it on paper. So, we're really pleased with the response that we got. And now we're hoping, that the community is going to kind of take that forward. We think there's some real opportunities, especially given the redevelopment of the courthouse and the church there. We think this could be a real opportunity for Harbor Grace to really get some momentum around its heritage assets.
How important is the business community? Because as we know, local business people have been very heavily involved in this process, especially in Harbor Grace with the courthouse and the Immaculate Conception. So, how do you get business owners sort of on board or interested in these kinds of properties, especially business owners who see the value in heritage?
Well, there are a number who do that on their own. So Brenda O'Reilly, for example, she's one, and Craig Flynn, her partner, and they've acquired a number of heritage buildings in St. John's, and they got the courthouse and Immaculate Conception. So they already get it. I think in other cases, by doing studies, doing some visualizations, we're hoping that we're kind of stimulating people's sense of, oh, geez, I've always had a business idea, and this could maybe be a good place to do it, because heritage buildings often come with a certain amount of cachet. They're beautiful structures, iconic. They're often kind of central in a community. So I think it's just kind of, in some cases, just showing people, well, what's possible. And the business community has a huge role to play in preserving our heritage. We need that kind of private investment in buildings and, finding new uses. And of course, heritage is an important part of our tourism. So, you know, we just have to look at places like Trinity and Bonavista to see what the potential is in these heritage buildings for tourism and for business ventures.
Are there any particular buildings or types of buildings that are in peril right now?
Well, I think our churches, for sure. I mean, we're seeing the closure of historic church buildings all across the province. Even in St. John's, you know, we have a number of historic churches in the central core, and I know that many of them are challenged to pay for the operating costs, the maintenance costs on these buildings. So that's definitely one. I think another area that there's maybe not a lot of appreciation for is maybe our industrial heritage. And then old industrial buildings are often great for adaptive reuse. We've seen some really good examples all across Canada and elsewhere of how you can create really dynamic spaces. And I think as well some of our, you know, the community institutional buildings like old schools, courthouses, that kind of thing. Probably, you know, we have kind of two challenges in this province. In rural communities, there's often not the economic demand for property, so they just kind of molder away. And then in St. John's, there's often the value on, you know, these properties are on very valuable land, or these buildings are on very valuable property, and so there's pressure to tear them down and redevelop into something else. I think we've got those two problems or challenges in our province.
We often think of heritage as quite old, but heritage can be something even a lot more recent. And there's a lot of great buildings in around St. John's that date to the 50s and 60s that are just so beautiful. And some people just overlook them. And sometimes through neglect, they end up going by the wayside. What about newer type of heritage buildings?
I'm really glad you mentioned that, because I agree that we talk, you know, our modernist heritage dates from sort of the 1930s on, you know, and sort of the classic period is sort of 1930s to the 1970s. And, you know, a lot of these buildings now are, you know, 50 to 90 years old. And they really capture an important period in our development. And I think many people maybe, you know, they're not as ornate as a lot of our older buildings, so maybe people don't appreciate them in the same way. But many of them are actually quite beautiful. And again, they're an important, part of the our history and the development of our community. So we've been a few years ago, we changed our designation criteria to include modernist structures. And so we were able this past year to designate the first one, which was actually the pedestrian bridge in Bowring Park. So we're, and the city is now is working on a study to look at preserving, doing some restoration on that structure. So we really would like to see more people come forward to seek designations on their modernist buildings.
I know we still have quite a few, you know, Art Deco kind of style homes, and like you say, those 30s, early 40s type structures that are, you know, just regular homes, and when they get sold, they get, you know, completely cleaned out.
Or you know, modernized or changed. I mean, I think of Queen's College on the Munn campus. So that was one of a number of buildings built, I would imagine, probably in the 1970s, these brick ones. And so the building needed some repair, and it was clad with very contemporary materials. So the brick was covered over, and some of the architectural features were, well, the building was really reinterpreted. And so, you know, I know buildings need to be updated, and one of the challenges with modernist buildings often is that they're manufactured building materials that maybe don't last as long as, you know, the wood and the stone that we used to use to build our buildings before. So they come with their own sets of challenges, but I think it's really important that we recognize them for what they are and do our best to preserve them.
My guest today on Target is the Executive Director of Heritage NL, Jerry Dick. We'll be back right after this.
Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
And we're back. My guest today on Target is the Executive Director of Heritage NL, Jerry Dick, and we've been talking about heritage and some of the challenges faced there. And I know that Bonavista has done a lot of work in helping to preserve the some of the wonderful heritage in that area, built heritage. But what's the latest on Alexander House? Any word?
Yes, I think they've got an announcement of some of the funding. They've been working for a number of years to try and put together a funding package to restore that building. So I think that's all coming into place now, we're quite pleased about that. That's a really important heritage structure. And when I was driving into Bonavista past summer, I did some staycationing there, and I was coming into the kind of downtown area. I looked at that building and I thought, oh boy, what will it look like when this building is restored? So my understanding is the plan is to turn the ground floor into a high-end seafood restaurant, and then to on the other levels of the building to do an interpretation on the architectural history of the region. And really, to date, we don't have any museums or really that interpret this subject. So we think that's going to be a really great use for that building, and will be a real, just kind of the cherry on the top in terms of the great work that's been done in Bonavista around built heritage preservation.
Is that one of the oldest buildings in the province right now?
Well, our understanding is it was built between 1812 and 1814, if I'm correct on that. If that's the case, it would be the earliest documented building that we know of in the province. So that's not to say there aren't ones that are older, but in terms of having, the documentation for it. So, even just from its age, it's a really important building. But also, it's missing some bits, and the plan are to put that back, that, it will be a very impressive Georgian residence for someone who is a leading merchant in the community at that time.
Despite the long history here, why do so few structures last, so to speak? I mean, for something 1812, that's relatively recent compared to some other cities in North America. Why don't we have any structures older than that?
That's a good question, and I've thought about that one on many occasions. I think there are a number of reasons. One is maybe just the way this province developed, that, the original settlement was often kind of seasonal, so people would build temporary structures. They might live in Newfoundland. This would be going back to the 17th century. They might live in Newfoundland for a while, and then they would go back to the British Isles. So I think there was kind of, maybe to some degree, there was sort of a temporary nature to many of the buildings. And I also wonder whether it's just kind of a very pragmatic sense of buildings. Like, in the United States, like anything that's kind of from their colonial period, there's a great pride in that. Whereas I think we just take a very, historically, we've taken a rather utilitarian approach to buildings. So, when it's served its need, we tear it down. So, there are historic photographs of what were some pretty impressive early heritage structures, but, they were torn down a long time ago.
I know in the UK the big thing now is barn conversions, and I don't even know if they are actual barns or they just use that as a selling point, if you know what I'm saying. So there's lots of old structures that no longer have a purpose. If you don't own livestock, you don't need a barn, so what are you going to do? You're going to turn it into a living area. Is the same true here in the St. John's area? I know there's just a handful of some of these old carriage houses type things, and are there any movements afoot to have those preserved, or should they be preserved as is, or should they be turned into housing?
Well, I think, first of all, why are people, say that case in the UK, why are people looking at barn conversions? I think it's because I see a real quality and character to these buildings. There's beautiful old timber, stone, brick that people value and see, and then you can create, you can turn those into some pretty incredible spaces. I myself have turned an 1870s church into my summer place, and it's just an incredible space, that big open space to be in. I think that definitely carriage houses, it's really important that we look at, permitting the adaptive reuse of those. Like probably housing is a really good option because generally these are located, in the backyard of a residence in downtown St. John's. So, and I think it's an area that the city is looking into, and, there are lots of cities across North America that have, allowed the conversion of these kinds of structures into secondary homes or rental properties or whatever the case might be.
Has the pandemic and, some of the changes that we've had to make adapting our own lives over the last little while, has that been good or bad for heritage?
Well, I think it's certainly created some challenge. I think it's, on both sides of the equation. I'm quite familiar with the Battle Harbor Historic Trust, and they made the decision early on that they just didn't think that was viable because they rely a lot on out-of-province tourists and they weren't going to have any. But what they were able to do with the various support programs that were there, like to keep their employees on and some grants they were able to get materials, they've actually used that opportunity to, get the whole place kind of spick and span and to do work on a number of their buildings. So for them, it worked. I think in terms of, culture more generally, it's been challenging to reach audiences, but, some groups are using social media and digital means to kind of keep doing what they do, which is to share their stories with the public. So I think to some degree it's kind of helped us move along. But I know it's been a real challenge for many groups. I mean, they just, they weren't able to open their doors. They just didn't have the revenue to allow them to do that. And, it's a big question as to what's going to happen this year. I'm doubtful that it's going to be, tourism as normal. So, what's that going to mean at 2 years of closure? So, it's certainly a serious issue and challenge for many groups.
You said one of the things that you'll be looking at now in 2021 is helping to identify buildings at risk. Any other sort of focuses in the year ahead?
Well, certainly the training piece. We have an MOU with the College of North Atlantic, whereby they've been coming in and doing some digital scanning of some of the buildings. So they have a funding proposal that they're hoping to get some significant funding. So they're going to partner with us. So we're keeping our fingers crossed on that one. Otherwise, I guess it's just kind of business as usual. One of the areas that the foundation is looking at increasingly is this whole issue of inclusion, diversity. So we've kind of done a research paper on that and want to look at how we can ensure that we're more inclusive in the stories we tell. The whole issue of reconciliation with Indigenous communities that we want to do more to address some of those areas. So those are a number of things that we have on our plate over the next year or so.
Jerry Dick, a pleasure as usual. I really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you. Always a pleasure.
Thanks very much. And we'll be back tomorrow. Of course, it's going to be an historic day in the history of North America, really. The inauguration of Joe Biden as a U.S. president. And we anticipate that it will be watched by a lot of people. So we're looking at the possibility of airing some of that live tomorrow during On Target. So stay tuned for that. And otherwise, I want to thank you all for listening.